As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello, welcome back to Full Time with Meg Linehan. You are listening to a show all about women's soccer on The Athletic Podcast Network. I'm Meg, your host, and I'm a national staff writer at The Athletic covering the NWSL and the U.S. Women's National Team. I will be at the two U.S. Women's National Team send-off games in Connecticut this weekend, technically Thursday, today, and Monday. So, you know, the joys of driving to Connecticut twice in the span of a few days, plus the Gotham FC game, assuming the weather cooperates. We've also had some wild NWSL action with the Orlando Pride, still at the top of the standings through June, and a ton of other news to boot. On today's episode, Katie Donovan of the Sports Innovation Lab is here to talk through their new report at The Fan Project, which asked fans to send in their social media data from Twitter and Facebook. And the team anonymized that data and compared it to other industry data and trends. And recently they released a major report detailing how to best invest in women's sports. There's a lot to dig into. This episode is hopefully helpful if you have read the report or not, but I feel like if you are listening to this podcast, you at least have a passing interest in the future of women's sports. Data like this is definitely crucial to figuring out the next steps. Again, you've heard me talk a lot about that at The Athletic. Again, we've just hired a second full-time women's soccer writer. Part of that is because of the data. So before we get into all of this, again, your reminder to subscribe to The Athletic at theathletic.com/full-time. We have so much in the works on so many different fronts, but with the Olympics coming up, we've got a ton planned, and we'll be working closely with our UK desk to bring as much coverage of the women's tournament to you as possible. It is July. It's the perfect time to subscribe if you haven't already. TheAthletic.com/full-time. Let's start with some news from last night. Olivia Moultrie has finally signed an NWSL contract with Portland Thorns FC, and it is for 3 years plus an option. This has been quite the legal saga, but the judge in the case gave a very clear deadline that would ensure Moultrie could get on a plane as the Thorns travel to Louisville for a game on Saturday, and she will actually be able to get on that plane. Paul Tenorio has been leading the way on the coverage on this one for us at The Athletic, and for more, we've got a headline, plus I popped on our breaking news podcast to explain it all. Angel City FC unveiled their new crest on Wednesday. Now, this one is obviously a little hard to explain in the podcast format, but Steph Young has the story at The Athletic. I highly recommend that you read it. The Zone has acquired the global rights to UEFA's Women's Champions League from 2021 until 2025. For the first two seasons of the cycle, every single match from that new group stage on will be streamed live and free on YouTube. For the second two seasons from 2023 on, DAZN will shift games onto their OTT platform, but 19 will still be streamed free on YouTube. I have plenty more on this at The Athletic. Now, last week it was all about the Olympics roster for the U.S. Women's National Team, and on Wednesday we started to hear some rumblings that the IOC has actually decided to change how they approach alternates for this tournament. According to reporting from the AP's Annie Peterson and Rob Harris, the roster will expand to 22 players, but it will still be limited to 18 on game day rosters. This could mean, however, that Lynn Williams makes a game day roster if Tobin Heath isn't quite ready yet, or Katarina Macario steps in for Julie Ertz. I asked U.S. Women's National Team head coach Vlatko Andonovski about this on Wednesday's Match Day Minus One Zoom. Here's what he had to say. Quote, "We got word from the IOC that we will have a little flexibility on the roster. We're very happy about it, and as of right now, we're just waiting to see a little more detail on what all of the rules and regulations are going to look like. So stay tuned." All right, Katie Donovan is the Vice President of Data and Insights for the Sports Innovation Lab. She's here to help walk us through the newest report, which is all about growing women's sports and was driven by all of this fan data they collected. So let's just dig right on in. All right, Katie, I wanted to start maybe just first if you could give folks an introduction to who you are, what your background is, maybe what the Sports Innovation Lab is. All of that kind of fun stuff just to kind of lay the groundwork for when we actually get to the fan project and this report.
Absolutely. So I will start with Sports Innovation Lab. We are a tech-focused organization that is really doing a lot of data analysis and understanding around how technology is changing fan behavior. So ultimately, and we've been in the market for the past five-ish years, just shy of 5 years, but a lot of the research, a lot of what we have implemented with everybody in the market from the NFL to Google to Coca-Cola to Nike, it's spanned the breadth of who interacts with the sports industry. We are focused on giving them a lens into who their fan is, how their fan is behaving, and how they can translate that into revenue. And then the quick and dirty on me and stepping into this role with them, I've been with Sports Innovation Lab just since January. So I am a ripe 6 months into it. Lots of fun, but have spent the past 15 plus years working in data technology through a number of different kind of avenues, whether that be through entertainment or music, and now coming into sports. And the last probably decade plus of that has really been focused on understanding and analyzing fan behavior specifically in those different environments. So whether it was fans of SpongeBob when I was with Viacom for a few years, whether it is music fans when I worked with Spotify, or now sports fans. And I started my own company, a nonprofit called Shea Sports, that focused on increasing fan engagement with women's sports, which was a very natural transition now into the work that I'm doing with Sports Innovation Lab.
Perfect. All right. So let's shift over to the fan project, which I think I had mentioned it on this podcast as a thing that people can do. I know we have spoken about the NWSL supporter survey that I do at The Athletic, right? Like, women's sports fans, I think, are very willing to say, like, please take my opinions, yes, my data, my everything, yes, right? Because everyone is just kind of going, like, how do we fix, like, kind of the lack of data that everyone has going in? And I really wanted to read, so Angela Ruggiero, who is also a part of Sports Innovation Lab, also, you know, just kind of one of the biggest USA hockey players to play the game.
Yes.
But she's got this introduction in the report, and I really love this one sentence with, "As a four times Olympian and CEO of Sports Innovation Lab, I did not want to publish another opinion piece or demand investment from corporate social responsibility budgets as the, quote, right thing to do." And that is a line that really stuck with me, because I think that has been kind of the frustration for so long of just, like, what has the argument been for investment in women's sports? And there has been a lot of real pushback of this kind of cause, like, oh, it's a cause that you should care about. And so where do you think the fan project and this big report that the group just released shifts now that narrative away from the right thing to do and just like, oh no, this is actually a thing that you should be doing because it makes sense?
I mean, legitimately, when we set out to do this, the original intent was to unlock the business case for women's sports. For so many years, and you have been at the center of this and these conversations within the women's sports kind of side of the sports industry, a lot of the conversations have been based around anecdotal information, moments in time, rather than consistent and data-driven approaches to those conversations. Or it's quite frankly been based on gut instinct. We've walked into pitches, and I've done this myself. I've walked in asking for sponsorship within this space and gone, I know that this is here. I know that this is right. I know that you're going to see this return on investment, but no, I don't have the numbers to concretely show you that that's what happens. You're just going to have to believe me. And so a lot of the industry has been saying a lot of the things that are in this report, but they've been saying it from this gut instinct or this anecdotal place and using that to prove their worth. What we did and kind of the novel approach to it was, as you said, fans of women's sports are motivated to help this space. They are loyal to this space. They are ingrained in it. They want to help. And so when we put the call out to say, hey, you know that your data is being used all over the place. You know that you're getting targeted for all of these ads, some of which is great. Like, everybody loves a good Instagram ad every now and then, but like most of it is just stuff that you don't care about. It's stuff that you're not personally motivated by. Why not have your data get used for something that is finally going to really have a monetary impact on this space? And they responded in hundreds, in literally 10 million data points worth of response in just a very short amount of time. I mean, we were collecting data over about a 2-month period of time in total. And to get that many data points to be able to analyze that much, for us, this was a proof of concept to see if that response would come through. The fact that it did, the fact that we were able to analyze as much as we were, has now unlocked a massive opportunity and massive go forward for us to really take this to the next level. And that all harnesses around the business potential.
In terms of the response that you got from fans, but also there were leagues and other kind of institutions as well that also partnered.
Yes.
The Sports Innovation Lab. But were you surprised? I mean, I feel like probably neither of us were really surprised that this was happening. But just in terms of, I mean, the data goes back to 2007, right? It seems like there was also a pretty even split between men and women in terms
yes.
of what you were able to get. I know yeah. we're going to talk about demographics a little bit later on, but just in terms of response, was there anything that stood out to you from the actual data collection part of this process?
The biggest surprise for me was genuinely how far back it went and how robust the data was when we started looking back at those years, you know, 5+ years back. Like I've said this a couple of different times, like I for sure would have expected that just engagement 2 or 3 years ago, 2017, 2018, like we started to see this kind of real uptick in engagement with women's sports. I definitely was expecting to see behaviors starting to really show up in the data around those years. To have it go back as far as it did, to be able to track these different behaviors, these different moments in time as far back as 2007, and to be able to see in a longitudinal fashion the evolution of how fans are behaving and engaging with this space over that long of a period of time taught us so much, and at such a level and a depth that we felt really confident in being able to go to the market with the report that we did. And again, being able to put real data-backed assertions into this space that we feel can move that business case forward.
Okay, so next, there's the concept of a fluid fan.
Yes.
That is at the heart of this report. And I think as you describe it, probably every single person listening to this podcast is just going to go like, oh yeah, that's what I do, right? But could
right.
you maybe
right.
let's lay the foundation of like, what is a fluid fan?
So a fluid fan is this concept of a fan that Sports Innovation Lab has actually been tracking for the past 4 years. And they put out their report on fluid fandom actually a couple years ago. So it's based on this ongoing research that they've done. The idea behind a fluid fan is that there's this evolution that has taken place in the marketplace where we've gone from kind of the early 1900s and this age of the local fan, where you didn't really, there wasn't really broadcast TV. So you're really newspapers and radio as kind of your media forms, or otherwise you were going to the game. You were a local fan, you were going to your local team. That's when kind of the business of sports sort of started to formulate around this local fan. Move into like the 1950s-ish, and you start to see the increase of broadcast TV. We start to move into this age of the global fan, where you have broadcast and satellite really driving a lot of fan engagement. Now, all of a sudden, you're not just restricted to the team that's in your local market. You can watch teams that are in other parts of the country or even other parts of the world just as easily. So now we start to see this shift that happens from, hey, I am a local fan of just this one team, to now I'm saying, yes, I'm a fan of this team, but I'm also a soccer fan. I'm also a baseball fan. And so there are these broader kind of league level followings that start to happen with the fan base. Now what we're moving into is this age of the fluid fan. And the catalysts for change here are really around the adoption of the smartphone, the internet in general, and how we're seeing the OTT space really expand and streaming technology, social media, the digital kind of connected, always on, always omnipresent type of space. And so now the fan base is shifting and behaving differently because of that. So yes, they're still very much consuming at that team and league level. They're still saying, hey, I'm a soccer fan. They're still saying, I'm a Gotham FC fan. But now they're also sitting there and going, I will follow Kaylin Sheridan wherever she goes. Whatever, whichever team she goes to, like, I'm going to be real conflicted on whether or not I'm choosing Team USA or Team Canada. Like, there's that level of following that is now happening and level of engagement. And we have moved concretely into this space of the creator. So whereas before you were just really more of a spectator or a consumer, now the fan is definitely those things, but they're also creating the content themselves. They're directly engaging in these social spaces.
This episode is supported by season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX is Welcome to Wrexham. Catch all new episodes Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I definitely want to talk to you about the creator part a little bit later, but just because I feel like everyone who is in this space started in that kind of, like, every single person in terms of my own, like, it makes complete sense. But first, yeah. I want to talk about that shift of traditional approaches to how sports make money. To yes. what we're looking at now. And the two things that I really took away from this report were the digital part of it, right? The fact yeah. that everything is now, our instinct is to turn to our phones, honestly, yeah. right?
Yeah.
Part two of that is also the storytelling part. And obviously that is a bias for me as someone who is paid to do that, right?
Rightfully.
I was hoping that we could maybe talk through the role of storytelling, because it is just more than what I do, right? That there is storytelling that's happening at the league level, at team level, at player level, right? That
yeah.
this is kind of the evolution of content itself, right? Yeah. And that some of these lines are starting to get blurred between what we consider content and what we consider coverage.
Yes. Yeah. And so, and I mean, this goes really to the core of what we put out in this report. Say there is this evolution of a monetization model that is happening within the sports space. and the benefit, because for so long, fans of women's sports have been relegated to these digital spaces out of necessity. They haven't had the linear deals, so they've gone to the streaming networks. They've been forced into those spaces. They haven't had the big marketing budgets or the big stadiums or these arenas. So they have created their own communities within social media and within these digital ecospheres. So there's this indoctrination that has happened with this fan base that, again, when we look at this data and we go back as far as 5 or more years ago, we're seeing a fluent use of these different tech influenced behaviors. Not just a little bit, a lot. Like, they are fully indoctrinated. They don't need an education. They know exactly where they're going, and they're going to the digital spaces first. Even when linear is available, they're going digital. So there's a really interesting monetization shift that's happening because of that. And what we're calling it is the community-based monetization model, because it's this idea that there are these at-scale communities, the Reddits of the world, sizes of communities that exist in these digital spaces that are continuing to really evolve and encapsulate this fan base. And again, fans of women's sports are the most condensed group of these fluid fans who are existing in this space because of their indoctrination. So now what we're starting to move towards is saying, okay, how are they existing in this space? If they're this early adopter, if you will, of this monetization model, of this digital ecosphere, how are they existing? How are they interacting? What are they interacting with? Storytelling is a big piece of that. We saw, for example, if you look at the WNBA in their 2020 season, 62% of their increases, their bumps in viewership, in linear viewership, were driven by storytelling content, stuff that went beyond the stats, scores, and schedules. It was all around the different aspects of the players as whole people, of the movements that they were talking about, the racial justice movements, the voting movements, the women's empowerment movements. It was the storytelling around that that quite literally we can see the correlation to those storytelling lines going out and shifts and bumps, major bumps in viewership. So we can see really the importance of that level and that type of content engagement. And then what we're also starting to see, and we broke this down into kind of three areas: produce, distribute, and measure. So produce is really your storytelling lens. Distribution starts to shift away from it just being a linear monopolization and instead moving into this space where, yes, absolutely linear is still going to remain a part of the play. It is where consistent and accessible coverage can live. But there's also this shift into the OTT spaces, into these digital spaces in, again, a really fluent way. And how are you really optimizing that? And then from a measurement perspective, once you understand storytelling, this great new distribution into these digital spaces and this omni-channel type of presence, then when you measure that, you have to look at the depth and the quality of that engagement. It's not just about saying, hey, how many eyeballs are on screens or how many butts are in seats. That's a traditional model. Instead, look at what is the quality of engagement? How are you connecting with purpose-driven or fan value alignment in order to really deepen the engagement? And that directly correlates to increased revenue, increased brand affinity. We have a number of different things within the report that kind of showed those upticks.
Yeah, I definitely wanted to talk about this idea of quality over quantity, because I also think, you know, one of the things that is discussed in here is in terms of like percentage of a game being watched, right? So like more people are tuned in longer to a WNBA regular season game than an NBA playoff game. And part of that is just, you know, it kind of is simple enough that, well, NBA playoff games are on television. If it's an exciting fourth quarter, right? Like you're going to get people kind of tuning in just to like, I mean, I do it all the time, right? Like if I see Twitter popping off, I'm like, well, I guess I should put that on. Like,
right.
You know, right. Like I guess I should know what is happening right at the moment. But in terms of like the depth of people watching, but also I think one of the real things is for, you know, using an NBA example, right? Like, I grew up a Boston Celtics fan, so I'm going to be very engaged in watching Boston Celtics games. I still might not watch all four quarters, but like, it's going to be more than me tuning into, you know, the Hawks playing right now in the playoffs. Whereas I feel like, and this is again, like where we talk about this kind of anecdotal thing of, for NWSL people, for instance, they're going to, if the game is on and it's on a time where it doesn't overlap with another game, they're probably going to be tuning in. It's not just like, oh, I'm going to be watching my local team. It's, I will watch any team in this league and have an opinion. I will watch playoff games that do not involve my team. I will watch the championship regardless of who's in it. Like, there is kind of this much wider approach to watching the league as a whole.
And that is fluid fandom. That is exactly what you're describing, is hitting the nail on the head, is this idea that there is a mission alignment. There is a value alignment with what you're participating in. As a women's sports fan, I want to watch because I want to support women's sports as a whole. I want to support these athletes. I want to support the growth of the game. So there's that value alignment that, again, literally translates into dollars. We see, you know, thanks to our partners at Zoomf and some of the data that they supplied for the report, we can see that for brands that have sponsored those leagues or those teams, in almost every single case, they have twice the brand affinity with women's sports fans as they do with general sports fans. So take Budweiser, for example. They sponsored the NWSL, and in our data, that happened in 2019, directly after the Women's World Cup. In our data, we saw an instant jump in behaviors directly correlated to Budweiser, fans directly engaging with, buying, whatever it might be, with Budweiser. That jumped more than 1,000% year on year. Like, that's an insane jump. And they had something like a 2.4 times brand affinity with NWSL fans versus what the general fan base has an affinity towards Budweiser. So there's this instant uptick for brands that engage in this space, because again, that loyalty, that fan base is the most fluid of all, and they are really looking at the entire women's sports ecosphere and going, I want to support that. I want to make sure that it has my affiliation, my support behind it.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because, I mean, previously Budweiser had sponsored the national team, right? But that did not necessarily create the same response. It's not like Budweiser does not sponsor men's sports. They sponsor men's
That's
sports
right.
all over the place.
All over the time.
That's so right. It is really interesting to see that immediate shift of, even though previously, I mean, they were a longtime sponsor of the women's national team, right? And and this is kind of the storytelling of the Budweiser story, is they went, okay, well, how do we up the ante ourselves, right? And how do we truly show that this is something that we want to buy into 100%? But then that investment is then rewarded immediately. I think it's funny because even just on the story that I wrote, you know, last week of just the Mua sisters doing the beer with Harpoon, I mean, that was immediately sold out at the brewery. All of the merch was sold out. You know, I spoke to their CMO for the story, and it was, I think, a day and a half after the beer had technically released, and he was just like, we are blown away. By the response. It's just, that is...
And that's, so we define that in the report as the own buy behavior. And we look at where are there specific opportunities exactly like that, where fans want to participate through actual purchase, through owning a piece of that experience, owning a piece of whatever their favorite athlete or their favorite sports team or whatever it might be is participating in, or the brands that are directly sponsoring those athletes or those teams. And again, like, the power of having this data and having it longitudinally is that we can see over the course of time where behavior spiked based on different influencers. So, and I don't mean like people necessarily, like number of different markers or different points. So for example, and again, looking at the Women's World Cup, what we saw was that there was this massive spike in that own by behavior in the month after the tournament ended. For you and I, that's not a surprise because Nike had a 500% increase in their jersey sales and they sold out and they were, you know, completely under-resourced and it was a real missed opportunity from a monetization standpoint. But we've never had the actual data to correlate that to fan behavior where we show that immediate uptake in real fan behavior. They were looking to own and to buy that merchandise. Now we have that. We can do the same thing. Like if we look at the WNBA during their bubble season last year, they actually had their biggest uptick during the season because they were doing a lot around their orange hoodie. They were doing a lot around the phenomenal partnership with the Say Her Name campaign and the Breonna Taylor support. There was a lot that they were doing around merchandise during the season. But what's interesting is that even then, when we look at that owned by behavior after the season, it still stayed up at about twice the rate that it was before the season started. So it's creating this continuous flow of behavior even after the season ends. And again, it's having that data that then can translate into, okay, brands, you can now plan appropriately if you're going to do a sponsorship or a partnership with women's sports. Here's what you need to consider in terms of how fans are going to react and behave, where you need to be considering your inventory and your inventory costs and associated planning around that, where you need to be considering your marketing dollars and how you appropriately spend before, during, or after, even in between seasons or events. There's a number of different things that we can now really unlock with this data.
I truly hope the inventory planning, whoever is in charge of that,
Yes. Hopefully
is looking at it because every time.
And think about it from a men's perspective. Like, if the Lakers win a championship or the Patriots win a Super Bowl, is there ever a shortage of championship gear?
No, I mean, if the Patriots won a Super Bowl, literally you're driving down to Dick's Sporting Goods that night, an hour after the game.
And it's
jammed.
An hour
after the game, yes.
It's packed. Yes. All sizes. All types, everything is there.
I mean, it is a very stressful purchasing experience. I've done it for like a Red Sox World Series. So like it is, I don't want to say it's like a perfect experience. It's not, but
it's not, of course.
It exists.
Right.
There is merchandise. It's not usually the best stuff that happens, but like it's there, right?
It's
like,
there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's, anyway. The frustration for fans of women's sports. Like we're sitting there going, take my money. And now again, the power of what we've done and what we are continuing to do with building out this fan data lake is really being able to put real numbers behind that, real data, real observational data. Not what fans said that they were going to do. It's not survey. It's what fans actually went and did. Where did they buy? When did they buy? What did they buy? How can we learn from that to better inventory plan, to better marketing? There's any number of different business objectives that can be achieved with having this data and this access now.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
Okay, so let's talk about this behavior part of it, because one of the really interesting things, and I tuned in a little bit late to the discussion of this report the day that it dropped, but one of the big kind of questions was like, okay, well, but where's the demographic data?
Yes.
Which isn't really, it's not in this report, because what ultimately this report decided is the demographic stuff is not necessarily the most important stuff that you're going to find out about people. It's ultimately the behavior, like what they're right. buying, what they're listening to, what they're creating, how they're right. watching, how they're learning, how they're participating, what kind of access they have. Like, are they going in person? Are they showing up on site? Like, these are the actual behaviors of fans. And yep. for someone who has read actually a lot of literature about fan behavior, this is like a giant shift in terms yes. of tossing out. I mean, when experts say, like, build your ideal audience, or what does your audience look like, right? Like, that's the exercise. And they yes. want you to create a person and yes. say, like, this person is wearing
this fictional
a jersey.
Being.
Like, yeah, yes. exactly. But, like, yes. that is how most people who work in this space yeah. expect you to think about audience, is building a fictional person that you are targeting, and instead yes. of actually thinking about what is this person doing?
Correct. And this, I want to say, it's a new concept for the sports industry. It is not a new concept for other industries. So this is literally this type of mood-based, moment-based behavioral understanding is exactly what I helped to build out at Spotify. So from a fan perspective within the music industry, it is a robust concept. It is something that, and it's not just Spotify, it's Apple Music, it's Pandora, it's Tidal, it's any of them are using this behavior first type of understanding to better connect with fans on their platforms.
I mean, that makes sense just from a, sorry to like really go on a Spotify
yeah,
tangent, but like, I mean, I think about Spotify Unwrapped, right? And how that
takes
everyone, every single yep. year. I mean, I am 1000% and I'm a Spotify user. Like
yep.
that gets you, but also just like the built playlist, like all of that stuff is going to be behavior based and not who is this, you know, mid-30s lesbian
Correct.
In New York City. Like, they don't
Correct.
Really care about that. They want to know, like, what am I listening to right now?
That's right.
What do you listen to in the morning? Like, even the recent thing of like, what makes you a unique listener? What are you combining
exactly.
that no one else is doing?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's not a concept that has traveled into
that's
the
right.
sports realm.
And that's exactly right. And it's starting to. A part of what we have done with our clients, even before my time with Sports Innovation Lab, was through this kind of indoctrination of fluid fan behaviors and introducing this to a lot of the leaders in the industry who sit on our leadership board, who have already been clients with us. Like, we've been teaching them about this behavior first approach. And so it's been implemented in different ways, like the NHL and what Heidi Browning does in terms of their fan approach is very behavior-based. They still absolutely have a layer of demographic understanding that kind of plays a role, but they come at it from a behavior first approach. And that's a really important facet to this report, is that we were very intentional about saying, look, if you understand the behaviors first, it's not to completely dismiss the demographics, like the behaviors of Gen Z versus the behaviors of your 50 plus year old fan are definitely going to be different. We acknowledge that. And as we continue to do work, there's really cool stuff that we have plans to kind of break down into those types of demographic breakdowns and analyze behaviors within different segments of the population, looking at behaviors in different ways. But for this initial report, for this foundational piece, it needed to be made really clear that when you do that fictional profile creation of your ideal fan, that fan doesn't exist. You're targeting all of these like super ideal characteristics, and then you plug it into your Facebook advertising or into your Google ads and you hope for the best. And instead, what we're saying is, look, if you come at this from a behavior-based approach, and again, what other industries are already doing and doing it really well. So this exists in multi-billion dollar companies who have really harnessed this. If you do this well, then what you actually end up doing is connecting with the human behind the screen and understanding the moment and the mentality and the behavior that they're exhibiting at a given time allows you to then say, okay, I understand that you're at a game right now and you're probably feeling a sense of pride. You're probably wanting to cheer for you. You're not wanting to miss the game. So how can we use mobile first technology? How can we make concessions faster? How can we make your experience at the game a better overall experience? That all happens through behavioral understanding.
I did want to, obviously, when I was reading this report for the first time, and I'm reading, and then I get to the behavior part, and then I was like, oh, wait, The Athletic is here.
Yes!
So, and I was just like, let me send this to people right now. But I did want to talk through the learning part of it, right? Because I think that is, you know, they're all of these kind of live in a cycle. Right.
Yes.
And some of them are happening at the same time. Some of them are happening at particular points, you know, whether it's at the game, before the game, after the game. Some of them are happening at the exact same time, you know, like all of that kind of stuff. They're all interacting with each other, though.
Yep.
And some people, I personally do not bet on sports. I don't fundamentally understand it. But, you know, that could be happening at the exact same time as someone else being at a game. All of that kind of stuff.
Yep.
For the learning part of it, which I think is still a very crucial part of women's sports, simply because, I mean, the 4% coverage number gets tossed around a lot. But where did you see that intersecting with some of these other behaviors?
So the learn one was really super interesting to us because I think you're absolutely spot on, especially at this stage of women's sports growth. Learning about the athletes, having access to consistent content, consistent places to just go and learn about, sometimes it's stats, and there's a lot of engagement with stats with, you know, Sports Reference, for example, was another one that really spiked in our data. Like there is a real desire to understand more about these athletes, more about the sport itself. That type of learned behavior intersects a lot with listen. So a lot of people are going to the audio platforms. Obviously, podcasts, like what we're doing right now, are a genuine place that people really go. They're participating in those environments. They're going to those environments a lot to learn. So there was a lot of overlap with listen. There was also a lot of overlap with access. So access is all about how are the fans directly engaging with the athletes themselves. And there was a lot, like we saw Players Tribune, for example, also come up. We definitely saw a lot of the work that you guys are doing around storytelling, around the actual athletes themselves, giving that deeper lens and that deeper look into who these athletes are. Again, stats, scores, and schedules definitely is a part of it. It's not to be discounted, but there's this equal, if not almost more important, storytelling element of like fill out these athletes as whole people. Who are they as whole people? What are their lifestyles? What are their values? That's what fans are really connecting with. And yes, they still want them to perform. The product on the field, ice, et cetera, is still really important. But there's this element of who are they off the court that is equally as important.
So today there was some news just in terms of big media rights deal, global media rights deal between UEFA for the Women's Champions League and DAZN, which I always struggle to remember that DAZN is DAZN. But so part of this, just for folks who might not have seen it, but part of it is that the first 2 years are going to be entirely on YouTube. Every game from the group stage on is going to be free to stream. It will also be on DAZN's platform. And then 2 seasons into this 4-year, the deal runs the entire length of a Champions League cycle. they will then start to shift games onto their OTT platform. And as I was reading this, I was like, wow, okay, a lot of this really lines up with what is in this report in terms of kind of the future of where fan behavior is headed. And I was just wondering your reactions on what you have seen out of today's announcement.
So yeah, so I mean, absolutely phenomenal announcement to have not only that type of media rights deal come into fruition and just the level and scale of that type of media rights deal, but to have it be led by an OTT space and by an OTT provider, that is a really incredible, not only step forward for, I think, where the overall sports industry is really headed, but is directly correlating to how we are seeing fans of women's sports engage with content and consume content. So they could not have done a better job of really pinpointing how they know fans of women's sports are going to and have been consuming content and really leaning in to that. And on top of that, what I really also liked about the deal is that they are committed to increasing other content outside of just the game. So increasing storytelling content, increasing and deepening the content around the athletes themselves and creating storytelling moments to really highlight who these women are who are playing in these championship games.
Okay, so one last question. In terms of what fans can take away from reading this report, like I really think that they should actually be reading it, but what can they take away beyond just their own participation? How does reading this report help them or give them the tools to then influence the leagues, the teams, and the brands?
So first and foremost, it's where fans go to consume this content. So when they have a choice of turning on different games or of engaging with different content within social media spaces or within OTT environments, and the biggest kind of takeaway is lean into that and demonstrate through those numbers and through the quality of that viewership, how deep and how long fandom is really sticking around during these events or during these moments, building out these communities, demonstrating that that fandom truly exists and is continuing to grow is definitely a big step that is really going to take the women's sports space forward. From a league brand media tech perspective, from the business side of things, the biggest takeaway is that fans of women's sports are the way to future-proof your business. They are the most fluid fans of all today, right now. And they have been for the past 5+ years. So they are fluent users of these digital spaces and of really the spaces that are very much going to be the future of the entire sports industry. Understanding them, understanding their behaviors, understanding how to engage with them in ways that return on investment, in ways that really allow for a brand, for a league, for an entity to take advantage and really deepen the engagement with fans is going to come from understanding their behaviors right now and responding to that with, again, what we are calling the community-based monetization model, but by really leaning into how you produce, distribute, and measure differently and better within this space.
All right. Well, that sounds like a perfect ending. Thank you, Katie, for joining me on the show, also withstanding some technical difficulties of Wi-Fi in New York City. But I appreciate you walking us through this report.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you to Katie, who really did get to experience the joys of my New York City Wi-Fi failing on a truly miserable, hot, humid day here in the city. But to read The Fan Project, the link is in the show notes, or you can visit thefanproject.co. It's available directly on the website, or you can download it as a PDF as well. You can also follow @thefanprojectco on Twitter for more as well. Now, one more thing. If you are going to the U.S. Women's National Team match tomorrow, Harpoon will have the Team USA beer in the stadium. I usually try not to plug my own stuff in the section of this pod, but honestly, my story on Sam and Christy Mewis's beer with Harpoon was a story I absolutely loved writing. It is obviously the perfect intersection of my interests. Plus, I got a field trip to the brewery out of it to boot. Now, I'm not actually an IPA person, but it's not that hoppy, I promise. The citrus flavor definitely helps on that front. But to compare it to another Harpoon beer, since I love Flannel Friday, which is their big beer in the fall, it's right in that range of hoppiness. If you know what an IBU number is, Flannel Friday is 35. Team USA is 40. That is within, that is how I generally judge if I'm going to like a beer or not. Anything under 50 is usually safe for me. So it's not a big IPA profile by any stretch. Highly recommend giving it a try if they sell it in your area. Anyway, as always, the home for the show is at fulltimepod.com, where you can find links to all of the major podcast platforms. If you're enjoying the show, as always, your reminder that ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts do really make a difference. And of course, one more call, subscribe to The Athletic, and you can support all of our women's soccer coverage. You can help with some of this data. That link is theathletic.com/fulltime. My name is Meg Linehan, and you have been listening to Full Time with Meg Linehan. You can always find me on Twitter and Instagram at It's Meg Linehan and my work at The Athletic. Full Time doesn't exist without the work and support of senior podcast producer Michael Zimmerman. From The Athletic, I'm Meg Linehan, and thank you for listening.